Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Hello and welcome to Strong Tower Radio. This is Good Growing with the Garden Guy with Gary Heilig, Sue Majeure, and yours truly, Tom Majeure. We have Sue on the line from Kalamazoo. Welcome back, sister.
Hello.
And we have Gary. Gary is working remote here from Eaton Rapids.
Yeah. Health issues had something to do with that, but I'm here and ready to go.
All right. Well, Sue, will you lead us in a word of prayer?
All right. Heavenly Father, thank you that we are, however, with difficulty making it through this winter weather, and help us to continue learning so we'll be ready for the new growing season by looking at some of the things and possibilities for the coming growing year, and also to enjoy our house plants to cheer us up when it's all snowy and cold. But we appreciate all of the blessings that you've sent us in us and the things that you teach us about you and your character by learning about the things that you created and that we can grow. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Hey, Gary.
Mm-hmm.
What's your prediction on the maple syrup season? Is that going to be a February or is that going to be a March this year?
Well, you can never tell what's going to happen in Michigan because you remember in December we had some fairly warm weather. And then the bottom dropped out of the temperature, so everything is definitely dormant. But we just don't know what February is going to be like. So it might be a cold February. It might warm up again. The meteorologists don't have a hard time telling what's going to happen long term, so I'm in no position to do that.
Okay, you're going to defer, huh? So
I don't mind giving opinions and things, but I don't have anything to base it on right now.
There you go.
The way things are going, I expect we're going to see more snow because they were expecting us to have more snow this year. And if we have a lot of snow, that usually means that the temperatures are in a fairly narrow range. Because when it's really cold, it doesn't snow very much. So it's all up in the air right now.
All right. Hey, I got one other thing. We started a habit of, we'd make fresh squeezed lemon, have that in the morning, put it in our water. And we used to throw away the peels, the lemon peels, and somehow we got the idea that you could grind those up and you put that with blueberries and some other nice fruits and stuff, and it makes quite a zingy, refreshing way to get your day started. And something we used to throw away has now become one of our favorite beverages.
Well, there was a pastor that I had when I was a young person, and when he would eat an orange, he ate the rind and all. And there are certain Chinese dishes that when they stir fry, they use orange rinds. So rinds are edible, and there are nutrients in those rinds. But the thing that I would think about is we do use lemon zest, for instance, and orange zest. So those things are edible. The only thing I'd be concerned about is what pesticides had been used on that citrus and how persistent it was. Because normally we as people do not eat the rind, and they might have been thinking of that when they okayed the use of certain pesticides. I'd have to do research on that, but it is something that you might want to be concerned about, especially if you don't want to take in any more than you absolutely have to.
And what?
But I do eat orange rinds in Chinese food that we make, and of course we use lemon rinds for all kinds of things. I use it in frostings and various ways of getting a real good lemon deep lemon tart flavor.
And
I'm fond of the lemon and orange zest, but I don't like the pith. That always tastes bitter to me.
It is a little bit bitter, but I think there's some nutrients there too.
When you say pith, what part of the lemon?
We're talking about that white part that's between the peel and the actual flesh of the orange.
Okay.
When you zest a lemon, you just scrape off the yellow part and not the white part. So all
right.
of that white part between, Tom, between the yellow zest that we scrape off for flavoring and the fruit itself inside, that's considered the pith.
Yeah, and it's not the most great thing to eat, especially grapefruits. It's rough.
Mm-hmm. Ooh,
but
yeah,
it is
that
edible.
Would be.
I mean, you can eat it. Okay, so are you trying to avoid the quiz?
That could be because it's the Chinese vegetables, and you broaden the category.
Well, we're going to rename it Asian vegetables.
Asian vegetables, and, you know, I go to the Chinese restaurant. We did that just a week or so ago, but not that I've identified all the vegetables in the restaurant.
Well, they're all multiple choice, so that should help.
Okay.
So the first one is, which vegetable is commonly used to make kimchi in Korea? Is it napa cabbage, bok choy, daikon radish, or mustard greens?
It's the napa cabbage.
Correct. Is that what you were going to say, Tom?
I was stepping out of this one.
Okay. Number two, bok choy is best described as a type of lettuce, B, a non-heading Chinese cabbage, C, a spinach relative, D, a mustard root crop.
Cabbage.
B.
Bok choy.
Yep.
I'm going to go with B.
Likewise.
What about you, Tom?
It's likewise because I grew it once, so I'm pretty sure it's in that family.
It's B, a non-heading Chinese cabbage. Okay, number three, which vegetable has long white roots and mild, slightly peppery flavor? Long white root, and we've talked about this as being a cover crop. Is it A, turnip, B, burdock, also called gobo, C, daikon radish, D, lotus root?
The only one I recognize is the turnip. So
I always think of that as like a round thing, though, not long. If I was going for long, I'd pick the daikon because that's like a – yeah, I think I'm going to go with daikon.
Yeah, because it said which vegetable has a long white root. It is daikon. Okay, number four, lotus root is actually a tuber or a stem or rhizome, C, a true root, or D, a seed pod.
I am not sure if it's the rhizome or the tuber.
What do you think, Tom?
I'm going to sit this one out because I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, you have a 1 in 4 chance to get it. Is it a tuber? Is it a stem or a rhizome? Is it a true root or a seed pod? I'll give you... I'll take one out, a true root. So it's either a tuber, a stem, or a seed pod.
I'm going to guess that it's a rhizome.
I think so, too.
Yeah, that's what it is, a stem. It's a stem, but it's also called a rhizome. Good job. It has
a pretty pattern.
Yeah, really, it's really cool. Which leafy green is commonly used in Japanese dishes and is rich in vitamin C? Is it tatsoi, mizuna, komatsuma, or choisum? I guess it's komatsuna. Tatsoi.
Is it a sea vegetable or a garden vegetable?
It's a garden vegetable. I'll give you a 50-50, okay? which means I take away two of the answers. I'm going to take away A, Tatsoi, and C, Komatsuna. So what you have left is Choisum or Mitsuna.
I don't know. I feel inclined to the Mitsuma, but it's probably the other one.
Know what they say about guessing, don't you?
You go with your first instinct. So, I'll pick the Mitsuma.
And I'll take the Choi.
Oh, Tom, you should have listened to it's Mitsuma. All right. Number six. Which Asian vegetable is known for its spoon-shaped, glossy, dark green leaves? Spoon-shaped, so it's rather flat. That's what that means. Is it the tatsoi, pak choi, kai lan, or shiso?
Oh, I think maybe shiso.
Tom, what's your guess?
I'll just have to go with the sister.
You should try another one. It's tatsoi. Looks like it grows in a rosette. It's really flat to the ground. And you know what? When I do these things, I'm going to be ordering some of these things and trying some of them this year. I've tried a lot of the choys, but I've never tried the tatsoi. Number seven, Chinese broccoli is also called A, choy sum, B, bok choy, C, kai lan, or chi yu choy. D is yu choy. And I'll give you a hint. It was one of the ones that we just talked about in the last question. Is it choy sum, bok choy, kai lan, and yu choy?
I'm going to go with the first one.
I'm going to go with the third one.
Tom is right. Kai lan. And Chinese broccoli is really good, too. It doesn't have the huge heads like Americans do, but it's delicious. Okay,
is it
eight.
More like broccolini?
Yeah, it's similar to that. Very small head. And I love broccolini, and they get a premium price for that stuff in the stores. Eight, which vegetable has hollow, crunchy stems and is often stir-fried with garlic? Is it snow peas? Or water spinach, also called kangen, bamboo shoots, or bitter melon?
I'll go with bamboo shoots.
I think it's bamboo shoots.
I would have thought so too, but it's actually water spinach.
Oh,
kangen.
Yeah.
I would have got caught on that.
I didn't think it was the snow pea pods, although I adore those. Water chestnuts. Yeah. Oh, I love those. They don't really have much flavor, but I love their crunchiness. Oh, I do.
And you know what? When I do these different quizzes, I get quite hungry. I'm not kidding. I just start thinking about making dishes with all these different things. Okay, number nine. Bitter melon is best described as A, sweet and mild, B, spicy and hot, C, very bitter and is used medicinally, D, sour and tangy.
Sour and tangy.
Okay. How about you, Tom? What do you think?
I think Sue's made a good guess.
The name said bitter melon, and C said very bitter. So that's the one, C.
I didn't want to go with that because I've seen it in the store and people eat it. But I'm like, why are they eating something that's very bitter? I would think they'd prefer sour and tangy.
Some people do like bitter things. I wonder why some people, you think about blue cheese. Blue cheese kind of has a moldy taste to it, but people love it. I will eat a little bit just for the flavor, but you load up a salad with blue cheese, and I'm not going to eat it. But just a little bit is quite good.
That's so interesting because I know like China and Asia, they think cheese is unedible. They do not do cheese. Else, they do not like cheese.
I know somebody else that said cheese is unfit for human consumption. Mm-hmm. But anyway, moving on. Number 10, which vegetable is harvested as a young flower stalk and buds? Is it Napa cabbage, choy sum, daikon, or shisu?
I think the shisu, because that's like a leafy thing, if I recall.
Actually, I don't know what shisu is, but the answer is choy sum.
Oh, well, because so much for that idea.
If you don't harvest bok choy and pak choy and all of those, they will start to produce flowers. And all the stuff is still edible. Okay, number 11. Shisu is most similar in use to which vegetable or Western herb? Shisu is most similar in use to which Western herb? Is it thyme, parsley, basil or mint, or oregano?
I think parsley.
I'm going to give you a 50-50 on this one. We're going to eliminate parsley and oregano.
Okay.
So it's either thyme or basil.
The ones we're familiar with.
Mint.
Thyme, then. Thyme.
What do you say, Tom?
I'll have to go with Sue. She's right more than I am.
Man, you know what? Got you.
I'm having a terrible day.
Basil and mint. But you'll get them all next time. Okay, we have three more chances here. Which crop is often pickled to make something called taquan in Japan? Is it turnip, burdock, daikon radish, mustard green?
Well, probably either the daikon or
think about it.
Or the other. What's the one right in front of that? Say the answer again.
Turnip, burdock, daikon radish, mustard greens.
Okay, I'm going to try for the burdock.
Oh, no. Tom?
Well, I don't want to pick that.
Hey, giving him unfair advantage.
Come on now, Tom. Well, I'm not keeping score today.
Oh, good.
Turnip, burdock. Well, you said burdock. We eliminated them. Turnip, daikon radish, mustard green.
I'll go with turnips.
Man, you guys are getting whopped today. Is daikon radish?
Oh, it's probably the daikon.
Yep, it is. Number 13, which vegetable is known for long, slender pods and is sometimes called yard-long bean? Is it snow peas, fava bean, mung bean, or asparagus bean? You guys have got to get this.
Not the first two. Maybe mung bean.
Let me read the question again. Which vegetable is known for long, slender pods and is sometimes called yard-long bean? Snow peas, fava bean, mung bean, or asparagus bean? Tom, what do you think?
I'll go with asparagus because snow peas, what I've seen, are, you know, the pods are only about 4 inches long. And mung beans.
Yeah, mung beans don't have these long pods, and asparagus bean gives you an idea of the shape, and asparagus can get quite long, and that's the one. D is asparagus bean.
See, I wouldn't have picked that just because when you said the long, it makes me think of those, what do they call them? They're really long. They're like 3 foot long beans, and they're green, and you eat them green, not the seed part. That's what, when you asked that question, that's what popped into my head.
Yeah, the asparagus beans are long and slender, and they're delicious too. I used to go out to my garden, and I would get the beans, and I would just chop them up and then stir fry them with some Sichuan sauce. Man, was that ever good. I wouldn't eat anything but just the beans. Mm. Okay, because they're like green beans. They're just long green beans. Okay, number 14. Which Asian green tolerates cold well and is great for early spring and fall gardens in Michigan? Is it bitter melon, water spinach, tatsoi, eggplant.
Water spinach, maybe.
Tom?
It's a tough one. I think eggplant is pretty susceptible.
Bitter melon, water spinach, tatsoi, eggplant. And Sue hasn't been doing so good lately, so don't go with your dog.
I'm going with C then.
I think I should be offended because I'm doing so bad today.
I'm just trying to give Tom a little hint here. Which is it? Bitter melon, tatsoi, or eggplant?
I'm going to go with...
We can get rid of eggplant because eggplants don't like cold weather.
I know that.
I was going to say, that's a warm weather plant.
I'll go with C.
That's right, tatsoi. Yeah. Last one. Bamboo shoots are harvested from A, tree branches, B, underground young stems, C, flower buds, D, seed pods.
B.
I like underground.
Yep, underground young stems. And, you know, the bamboo shoots that we get from the can are garbage compared to fresh ones.
Hmm.
There was a restaurant here in the Lansing area. It was called Village Gourmet. And they used fresh bamboo shoots. Oh, I could not believe how good they were. Did it taste like medicine-soaked sawdust?
The reason why they're white is because they never see the light of day, so that's why
they're white. Yeah.
Well, very good. Well, we're going to have to take
a
break.
And there was nothing about water chestnuts in there. That's my favorite. I love the crunchiness of them.
Well, we can always have another one. I'm sure we didn't cover everything.
Well, just stay tuned. We'll be back after this break to talk about a number of your planning for your garden and to look at the fruit trees and what does this cold have to do? Has it had an impact for this coming growing season? We'll be right back. Good Growing with the Garden Guy, Gary Heilig, Sue Majeure, and Tom Majeure.
This is Ruthie Calkins from Tustin. The Bible tells us that heaven will be the dwelling place of God's friends. That's why I'm so excited about supporting Strong Tower Radio. Their unique blend of thought-provoking speakers, stirring inspirational messages, and heartwarming music reaches into the lives and hearts of each listener, helping them to develop and cherish a friendship with God. If this radio station has been a blessing to you and your family, why not join me and hundreds of others in supporting Strong Tower Radio with a financial gift? They're 100% listener supported and could really use your help right now. You can send your check to Strong Tower Radio, Post Office Box 567, Cadillac, Michigan 49601. Or you can visit their secure website to use your credit card at strongtowerradio.org. Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
We're back with Good Growing with the Garden Guy, with Sue Majeure, Tom Majeure, and of course, Gary Heilig. Gary, we're going to talk about seeds. When do you start your seeds?
Well, that depends on what you're trying to start, because, for instance, when we talk about vegetables, we usually say 6 to 8 weeks before we want to set them out, and then you also have to include the time that you need to harden them off. But when you are starting various types of perennial seeds, it's important that you read the directions, because they may require a seed treatment before you even plant them. And for instance, it might be a cold period for a certain length of time. Lilies, for instance, they require a warm period for a certain period of time, then a cold period, and then you start the seed. So what you want to do is think about when you want to set them out, how large a plant that you want, because that takes time too, and then how long do you need for the treatment of the seeds, and you count backwards as to when you're going to start to sow those seeds. So there are perennial seeds that you can start right now because they're not really fast growing. And I gave you an example. Lilies, for instance, is one that takes a while to get any size to them. And I will be starting some peppers probably the first week in February, because it takes a while for them to germinate, And I don't have a heated greenhouse, but I have plant lights all over the house. So I'll start some of those so that I have some nice large peppers by the time I set them out.
You mentioned how large you want it to be. Is that how large the plant is before you put it in the ground?
Yeah, you can, for instance, you could transplant a tomato that's only about 5 inches tall, and it'll do fine. Or you can let that plant get as large as what you see in a greenhouse, but obviously you don't want it to be producing fruit. If you do buy a big plant like that, you need to take all the flowers and fruits off, and that's more done to get people to buy the plant more than anything else, because it's harder for a bigger plant to get adjusted. But the size plant you set out does make a difference as to how long it's going to be before you get your harvest. So if you're growing them inside, I usually say 8 to 10 weeks, you'll have a larger plant. If it's 8 to 10 weeks, especially if you get to the point where you can set your plants out for the last 2 weeks outdoors under a tree or something, they'll grow a lot faster.
You know, I've noticed.
So you just have to plan ahead, and you need to read the directions, because there are a lot of seeds that you can start, annuals, biennials, and perennials, and you need to know what's the ideal conditions for each one of those to get started.
You brought up something that I've noticed in the last 2 years, at least in our area. You used to be able to buy flats. You know, one time they were 48s, and then they were 36s, and the number of the trays got smaller and smaller. I had trouble last season, maybe even the previous season, even buying flats of flowers that were more than vegetables more than 4 to 6, and they were really focusing on, you know, the larger plants that were in a, you know, maybe a half gallon container, and like you mentioned, some of them already have the fruit on it, the tomatoes already on it, to get you say, oh, that's a beautiful plant. But
the thing is, when you have a larger plant, it attracts your eye more, and if people see a little tomato growing on it, they'll say, oh, I'm off to a good start. But if the plant is already starting to produce fruit, it's going to put most of its energy into ripening that fruit when it should be growing vegetatively so that it can support a much larger crop later. So the people are attracted to the larger plants when they go to the garden center. Plus, they can charge more for them. And it doesn't take long for them to get larger plants in a greenhouse because they have ideal growing conditions.
So they don't have to plant as many plants? So the other thing is if you get a plant that large, would you even put it in the ground? You know, some people put them on their patios, and they're not in ground grown. They just want to go step out and grab some tomatoes, some produce.
It doesn't really matter whether you put them in the ground or in a container, as long as when you put something in a container, it's the appropriate size for what you're trying to grow. For instance, when we think about tomatoes, there are some small tomatoes of determinate types, that might be cherry tomatoes, that do not need a lot of root space, and you can put them in a smaller container. But if you are growing, say, an indeterminate tomato, which means it'll grow really large, then it needs to have a lot more root room, or the plant will be stunted and it won't produce as much as it can, and it'll tend to dry out a lot faster because there's so many roots in that pot. So you have to take those things into consideration. I would rather have a determinate tomato in a container than an indeterminate type, because the indeterminates get so big and they need a lot of space for roots.
And won't it be difficult to get a trellis or a way to string them up to keep them from just flopping all over the place?
No, you can do that, and you can make big cages, but the thing that you have to remember is that as the plant gets bigger and it gets fruit on it, and it has, say it's on a cage or something, when the winds are high, it might be top heavy and it can get blown over, especially if the pot is dry and you're using an artificial mix in it. So keep that in consideration as to how large you let the plant get, because I've had some that have blown over in some pretty strong rainstorms.
let's move to plant lights, and we've moved from incandescent and fluorescent tubes to LED. Are all plant lights created equal? Are they all of the same value?
No. The LEDs, or light, it stands for light emitting diode, those will cost a lot less to run than the traditional fluorescent types. And a lot of the LED lights now, you have three lights that you can turn on. There's one that gives you just blue light, one that gives you kind of red light, and one that gives you white light, which is what we call broad spectrum. It contains red and blue and green and all the visible light colors. And depending on what you're trying to start will determine which combination you'll use. Like, for instance, I have in my bedroom right now, I have one of the LED lights, and I'm using all of the different colors because I kept some gerberas that I grew outside during the summer. I put them in pots and brought them in, and they're growing under the lights, and I have all the lights on. But, for instance, if you use blue light, it tends to promote compact, sturdy plants. And so it encourages leaf development, stem development, and it's really best for starting seedlings and transplants, or if you wanted to grow some spinach in a flat, like leafy greens inside the house. Then you have red light. The red light dries flowering and fruiting, which you don't necessarily want on a transplant. It might be useful if you have some African violets in the house and you want them to bloom. Well, that's the light that's going to help to do that, and also the length of the light, that also helps. So it also encourages stem elongation, which contributes to the overall height of the plant. And then you have the white light, which I mentioned before was the blue the full spectrum, which has the red, the blue, green, and all the other colors of the rainbow in there. And plants only use certain ones, but it's more similar to sunlight than either just red or blue. And so if you wanted to use combinations, for instance, mostly blue and white will give you short, stocky plants, which is what you want. And it keeps them in a vegetative growth stage. If you give it white light most of the time with some blue occasionally, then you'll tend to have stronger stems, denser foliage. Then, of course, if you want flowering, then you want to use the white light and the red light, and you turn off the blue one. So that's one of the nice things about the LED lights is that you can select what spectrum you want to use, and you can have very small ones. Like I also have one in my kitchen that I mounted under the counter, and we have houseplants under that one. But Jess wants to start seeds and grow some microgreens, and it covers an area of about 2 feet by 2 feet in terms of how large an area it'll supply light to. So it's really cool, and they're not that expensive.
I've learned some things here. I have some lights. I've had them for all of 2 years, more than like three, that have red and blue lights in there and such. But in your lights, you can select which ones. If you want more blue, if you want blue on, you can turn them on, turn those
on.
That's
right. Yeah, that's interesting. You can put them all on at the same time if you want, or you can put blue and red on at the same time, or just red and white, or blue and white. And depending on what you're trying to do, and when you buy those lights, they'll usually have some information in there that tells you if you're trying to grow XYZ, this is the light combination you want to use. Hmm. They're quite nice. I enjoy them. What I want to do is probably get another one and do some experiments with growing seedlings and grow them under the different types of light. Light might be all white, and then one be all red, and then all blue, and then compare what the plants look like under each one.
Where do you usually pick these multi-spectrum with the selectable?
Where to put them?
Where are you picking those up at?
Oh, I bought the ones I have here at Home Depot or Lowe's.
Okay.
They carry those kind of lights. They carry larger ones and they carry smaller ones. And then any hydroponic supply store will also have them.
Okay.
And, of course, you can get them online.
What about the, let's turn a corner here on the cold temperatures. That's when we're recording it, all we can think about is cold temperatures. When we air it, maybe we'll be through this little patch here, but a brutal cold here. What are you seeing right now? What are you predicting?
Well, when I start seeing really, really cold weather, I get concerned about what shape my flower buds are going to be in. Are they going to make it through the winter? Now, depending on what you're growing will determine how likely you are to get damage. And there's certain things that you have to think about, too, in terms of how susceptible those buds are to damage, other than just cold. But, for instance, apples and pears are very much hardy. They can get down to minus 25 to minus 30, and they'll be okay. But with peaches, minus 15 to minus 20, you have problems. Apricot, minus 10 to minus 15. Sweet cherries, minus 15 to minus 20. And tart cherries, about minus 20 to 25. So peaches and apricots are the most sensitive ones. Now, there are a couple of things that you have to be concerned about. Is what shape were the trees in when they went into dormancy? In other words, a tree that's not well fertilized, it's not properly pruned, that produces weaker buds, then you may lose buds at a lower temperature than what is published. The fertilizer status of the plant, in terms of if they're getting too much nitrogen, those buds don't go into complete dormancy. What kind of weather you've had before the cold snap comes. So if, say, for instance, it's been a very warm fall and then all of a sudden the bottom drops out, you're more likely to get damage. And even if you're pruning too early, you can get desiccation on the branches, and that can cause buds to die. And how long it's cold makes a difference. How fast the temperature drop makes a difference. And at this point, I'm a little concerned more for peaches and apricots, because I have an apricot tree in the front yard. But I will be able to check when we get around April. I can take some cuttings, or late March, and bring them in and put them in water, and then I can let them open up and bloom inside, and then I can check the ovaries to see if they're green or if they're black or brown. And if they're brown, then that flower, even though it looks nice, won't ever produce any fruit. So,
you know, about 15 years or so ago, I was talking to a peach farmer, and that particular year we had had a early thaw. It was real pleasant, you know, it lasted, but all of a sudden, the bottom fell out and it froze. And he said that he didn't talk about the buds on his tree, you know, the thing that you're talking about. He said that he was going to have to scrap pretty much a lot of his peach trees, because he said what happened is the sap started to rise, and then we had this polar plunge, and the sap froze and cracked the branches and everything. And he says, I can't, you know, it's not about the crop this year. It's that I'm going to have to just rip the trees out and try to find money to start over.
And the problem with that is when you get a crack like that, when the season starts, it's a great place for perennial canker to get started, which it can't be treated. And that will shorten the life of the tree quite a bit. And a farmer can't be bothered with that. They have to have producing trees. And also it makes the tree much more susceptible to peach tree borers. There's a lesser peach tree borer, and then there's just a peach tree borer. And they are insects that are attracted to trees that are in stress. And so they will lay their eggs by any wound, whether it's a pruning wound or cracked bark or whatever, and then they bore into the plant. And you can't really do anything about it once they're inside. So they used to use a material called Lorazban, if I remember correctly, but I don't think that they're still using that. And if you don't have any way to stop the borers from getting in, then the tree's going to decline. And the reason why peach trees are shorter lived in Michigan is because of perennial canker, peach tree borers, and winter injury, those three things. So when I had planted 99 peaches, I think it was 1991. That year, that winter, we had a really bad freeze, and the wind came out of the east and it was so cold that it killed two-thirds of my trees. And actually, the last third limped along for the next 15 years. They never produced and never got as large as they should have. Mm. Had I been a commercial grower, I just would have had to rip out everything and start over.
Listeners, we'll pause for a moment and give you a break, and we'll be back after this break. This is Good Growing with the Garden Guy, Tom Mazur, Sue Mazur, and Gary Heilig.
Many people make New Year's resolutions about things to improve their physical health. Eat more vegetables, start exercising, stop smoking, etc. If followed through, such changes have the power to literally add years to your life. But have you ever considered making spiritual resolutions too? Good spiritual habits like regular time in prayer, faithful church attendance, and daily Bible study can not only add quality to your life right now, but most importantly can establish a faith in Christ that will extend your life into eternity. If you want to turn over a new spiritual leaf in the coming year, why not commit to studying the Bible? Visit BibleStudyOffer.com and sign up for your free lessons today. You can receive lessons and study on your own, or a local representative will be happy to study with you, all completely free of charge. Visit www.BibleStudyOffer.com today.
We're back with Good Growing with the Garden Guy, Gary Heilig, and Sue Mazur and Tom Mazur. Gary, we were talking about inferring that pruning during very cold weather might not be advisable. It may cause damage. The trees are under stress. What can we do in this cold month?
If you just have a few trees in your yard, you can wait because you can even prune into June. It's a little harder to see what you're doing then, but you can still prune even once the leaves start coming out. But if you have stuff that has to be done because you're going to be busy, I would start with the apples and pears, and I do the minor pruning, like if you have water sprouts, obviously dead branches, suckers down at the base, and then wait a little bit longer before you do the pruning where you're decreasing the height of the trees. Now, cherries and nectarines and peaches and plums, anything in the stone fruit family is much more sensitive to pruning during cold weather. So we usually like to wait until the last minute on those, especially apricots and peaches. And they can also get late season winter injury. So if that's a possibility, you want to prune lighter anyway. So you want to wait until the last minute to do the peaches, apricots, nectarines, cherries. You don't do a lot of pruning on cherries anyway, so.
Okay. Now, we talked about determining when you plant your seeds, but don't you have to order your plants first?
Well, when I talk about ordering plants, I'm talking about if you're going to be growing shrubs or perennials or those types of things. The people that order earliest are the ones that get the best stuff, especially if it's something new, like an award winner, or it's something that's in great demand. Those can be sold out by the time you get to March. So now is the time. I actually start ordering some stuff in December and January if I really want something and they're available. A lot of times the All-America Selection seeds aren't available right away, but whatever I can find, I'll try to get it. Otherwise, you wait too long and you miss out. Like, give you an example, there was a specific cultivar of paprika seeds I was looking for that they grow paprika in Hungary, and they go out so fast that if you don't order right away, you're not going to get a chance to get those cultivars. So get to it. I'm starting to send my orders in, and you should be reviewing what seeds you have and what seeds you need to buy, looking at how old your seeds are, and I keep a chart in my box to tell me how long the various seeds are good for. And once they've reached the upper end of that, then I start rotating them out.
Now, we've wanted to increase our blueberries and get later in the season. Is it good to order blueberry plants this time of year?
Oh, yeah. You can order blueberries, strawberries, brambles, any of those types of things. But what you want to do is think about when is the best time to plant in your area, and then when they normally will give you a delivery time for your area. But if it's too early, then you can contact the company and say, don't ship my order until such and such a date, and they'll do that. Otherwise, you're going to have to either heal things in or pot them up until you're ready to plant.
Mm-hmm. Is there a soil temperature you should be concerned about?
No. When you're planting perennials and you're planting fruits like raspberries or grapes or trees or whatever, as soon as you can work the soil, you can get out there and plant. Now, with vegetables, it's a little different because if you're direct seeding or you're transplanting, there are certain transplants that require warmer temperatures, like the tomato family, for instance. You can put them out there when the soil is cold, but they just aren't going to grow. And I kind of proved that one year because I was testing out, and I think I talked about this a long time ago, I was testing out something called a wall of water. And I planted a tomato in March. It was kind of a dry spring. And I would say it was about the third week of March. And I put the wall of water around the tomato. And that night we had like 3 inches of snow.
Hmm.
Now, the tomato, because of the wall of water around it, which is like a tent that has water in it, it would collect heat during the day and release the heat at night, and the tomato did just fine. It did not die. If it had been just planted in the garden, it would have died. But because the soil was so cold, it just sat there, and it did not give me any advantage over just waiting until the soil was warm enough for tomatoes, which would have been late May. So it was nice to try it, but I didn't gain anything by doing that.
Let's turn the corner and talk about soil science, a nutritional value of dried and.
The reason I put this in here is because I used to worm compost. I don't currently have any worms because we use all the compost and I have to start another bin. But I have this rule of thumb that I don't save any worms. I let everybody have freedom after they've done their job so they get to go into the garden. And so I start with a new group, and they'll compost things. And what I do is I save all my egg shells, and after they've dried out, I use an old blender that Jeff bought for me at Salvation Army or something, and I turn it into a powder. And it's a great source of calcium. I don't use it as a liming agent because you have to use quite a bit, and unless you eat a lot of eggs, you're not going to have that much. But you do get various things from that material. And also I save banana peels because they're high in potassium and some other elements. And I save potato peels, and they have some nitrogen and various other things. But I let all that stuff dry out, and I turn it into a powder. But if you just put it in the soil, bacteria have to work on it in order to convert it into a usable form for the plants to pick up the nutrients. So if you were to just put it out there in the garden, then it would be most of the season would go by before those nutrients would be available. One of the things you could do is just get a 5-gallon bucket and put those materials in there and then put some composting redworms in there, and they will compost all that material, and then all the nutrients will be ready. And it's like putting on an organic fertilizer. It's not very high in nutrient level, but it's something that would have been wasted otherwise. Now, some people may not want to go through all that trouble, but I'm retired now. I turned 72 in December, and I have time to do this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So I do it. And I do a lot of research to find out, well, when I'm throwing away, what nutrients am I throwing away that could be recycled into the garden? Of course, you could just put that stuff in a compost pile, too, but you have to be careful that it's buried in the compost pile. Otherwise, you'll attract rodents. But you don't want to waste it if you can help it.
Absolutely. Well, any gardening tips to kind of round out the hour for us here?
Like, what can you do at this time of year besides look at your lovely seed catalogs and order things?
Well, we didn't talk about houseplants at all, but there are certain things that you can be doing. You can start some of your seeds, for instance. Another thing that I would do in February and avoid the rush is if you have, say, a mower that needs maintenance, you don't want to do your own oil changes, greasing the fittings, changing the blades or sharpening the blades, the time to take your mower in would be February or March, because when you start to get to April, everybody starts thinking about that. I have a rototiller that is not working really well right now. I'll probably get it in February so that it's ready when I'm ready to rototill my garden. You don't want to take it in the week before, because they'll tell you, oh, well, you're about 4 weeks back, and then you won't be able to get things done. Get your tools sharpened. If there's, for instance, one of the things I'll be doing, I want to make a raised bed on wheels that I want to put between my house and the garage, and I can just roll that thing out if I want. And one of the things I'll be doing with it, I'll be doing this time of year, is starting to buy the big bags of soil. And when I go to Lowe's for something else, I'll just buy a bag of soil. And that way I won't have to buy 10 or 12 bags in the spring. If you have any repairs that you need to do on containers, or say you have some tomato cages that they start to come apart, you could do the soldering during the winter months. Maybe you might even want to paint them so that they don't rust as easily. So there are lots of little things that you can do, sharpening your pruning tools, changing the blades on your chainsaw. I have a little chainsaw that I use, a handheld one, for my pruning, and that comes in quite handy. You can start planning your garden, how you want to do the layout, thinking about what you had the previous year. You can get outside and start your pruning on, say, the brambles. Like I have raspberries that are everbears, but I only want them to bear in the fall, so I'll go out and cut everything down. And this, you can do it this time of the year. You can do it in March, too, or April, but you start getting a lot of stuff that you have to done in April and May. So what I can get done while it's cold is great. And one of the reasons I can work outside during this weather is the things that get cold the easiest are my feet and my hands. And I have some heated gloves that are battery-powered that even on the coldest day, my hands stay nice and toasty. And that's what limits how long I can stay outside. And, of course, I have long underwear and boots and all these things. And I'm just nice and cozy, so you can get a lot of things done. And the fresh air is great for you anyway.
You talked about, the mower and taking it in. If you're going to have it serviced in a small engine repair, I could just imagine that you want to slip in after all the snowblowers have, you no longer need those, but they have the people haven't started bringing in their mowers in for the spring tune-up.
Yeah, and I tell people that don't wait to the last minute, and I'm telling you this from experience, because I've tried to get my mower in, and it was kind of late, and they tell me it's going to be a bit of a delay, and grass doesn't wait for you in the spring. It starts growing, and I've had times where I had to wait for the mower, and the grass was literally a foot tall. So that can be expensive, I mean, in terms of time, because you have to mow it more than once, and then you have to rake it, and it's just a pain.
Absolutely. Well, it's been, it's just still kind of a slow month for us, but it'll be ramping up pretty soon.
Well, if you have a greenhouse also, it's time to get the greenhouse cleaned up and ready for starting your plants. Now, unless your greenhouse is heated, you're probably not going to be able to use it much until about late March, early April. When the sun is shining, it'll get quite warm in there, 70, 80 degrees. But it's the nights that you have to be concerned about. And there are a lot of videos on YouTube where you can make all different types of greenhouse heaters. And they also talk about different greenhouse heaters that you can buy that you can just use for some supplemental heat if the greenhouse gets a little cold at night.
You know, I have a friend that has a hoop house unheated, and that he looks forward to a sunny day in February. That's when he does his cleanup and getting all the old plants out. He waits till then.
Yeah, because on a sunny day in February in my greenhouse, it'll get up in the 70s. It's like spring in there. And so it's quite therapeutic, too, because when you're surrounded by plants that are starting to grow in the greenhouse and you see all your peppers and your lettuce and all the different things you started, it gets to be real quite exciting.
Actually, on one sunny day, and I don't know if it was February or March, we actually had a picnic lunch out in our hoop house because it was warm enough.
Yeah, and you have a pretty good-sized hoop house, so you could have a potluck in there.
That's right. Invite the whole church over.
Yeah, you could. I mean, you probably could get 40 people in there easily.
Well, that's been another great session of Good Growing with the Garden Guy with Gary Heilig. He was an extension service, and he's retired.
3-4 years.
Many years of personal growing and enjoyment, but on-the-job training. And so he's passing that on to you, our listeners, and Sue Majura, one who studies a lot of growth, reads a lot of things, and yours truly that try to keep it all together. For Strong Tower Radio, this is Good Growing for the Garden Guy, and I'm Tom Majura. Bye now.